You are tuned in to WPVMLP Asheville 103.7 on your FM radio and streaming at WPVMFM.org.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Mostly sunny today, the high near 86. For tonight, partly cloudy, low around 64. On Saturday, we'll see some showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon with a high near 82. Winds will be gusty at times as we head into Saturday night. More showers and thunderstorms possible with a low around 67. Showers and thunderstorms on Sunday with a high near 80. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today, my guest is Lori Wolf. Lori is a poet who lives in Colorado. She reached out to me a couple of weeks ago, telling me about the work she's doing and some of the leadership activities she's been involved with in Colorado with a large group of poets. Sounded interesting to me, so I decided to invite her onto the show. So today we talk about form. She reads some of her work that's old and new, and we just explore a conversation around the meaning of poetry, why it has value, why spontaneity applies, why precision applies, even talk a little bit about mathematics, poetry and mathematics. Wonder where that will lead. Well, let's find out. Here we go. So tell me more about what you mean by poetry that's accessible for you. What would be an example of that? And accessibility with poetry could be one thing for one person and another thing for another.
Well, absolutely true. People bring themselves to the poem if they're reading someone's poem, and so they bring the baggage or the experience of their life. And that's what I hope will happen, is that the reader, if I put my poem out to the world, then I have to let it go. Like when your children are grown, you do what you can to make it the best you can, and then you let them go. But I think the reader brings all of themselves to the poem, and I want them to be able to enjoy the poem, to know me a little bit as a person, to enjoy the words, ideally the craft, if they're poets, and to recognize that these words are not an accident. They are chosen precisely, if I've done my work right. But I try not to use too many big words or have lines that are too long. And hopefully the reader or the listener, if I'm speaking the poem, will enjoy and learn something. There'll be a takeaway, usually at the end of the poem, that gives them something to think about after they've read the poem. And hopefully my metaphors change the way they perceive the world.
So how do you make those kinds of decisions as a poet? And the reason I'm asking that is because I love to write. And I mean, I'm somewhat of a fan of precision, but I also kind of get bored with myself. And I think, well, I'll just go ahead and throw dog in there and be done with it. how do you make those precise choices?
I use form as a frame in which to operate. I write a lot of sonnets, and I like the form, the limit of 14 lines. I can't go on and on and on. I have to say what I want to say and be done, and be brief and not try to do too much. I have a sonnet that says, when you don't know what words to use, write smaller. Write about small things, not try to save the world in 14 lines.
I'm really curious about this because I was asking, or I was having a conversation with a friend yesterday. She's a singer-songwriter. She's coming out of Nashville, Tennessee. She's headed back to Nashville. She's got a slot at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, Tennessee. You don't go to the Bluebird unless you get invited. So she's got singer-songwriter Nashville chops for sure. And she writes some very powerful songs that got a lot of death in them. You know, they say, well, Carver, how many people are you going to kill tonight? I don't know yet. I'll sing a few songs and we'll see who dies.
So she was asking me about poetry and why poetry seems to stand out in terms of something that's demanding for people, whereas maybe offhanded storytelling's not. And I was trying to explain to her that I felt like the reason why poetry offered so many opportunities was because it was basically mathematical. And it was similar to high mathematics. You can go as far as you possibly can and then still keep going with poetry in the same way like the Fibonacci sequence applies. 1 and 1 is 2, 2 and 1 is 3, 3 and 2 yeah. is 5. And there's all this structure involved. And I said, working within that structure is something that people try to do. And they do it a lot. And then I said, also, you don't have to do it with structure. You can just write a poem on a napkin. And if you can get somebody to say it's a poem, then it's a poem. And then you say, I'm a poet. Be done with it. Or you can go on and on and on. So there's that range. And so that was yesterday. Yes. We were having this conversation at about the same time. We met at 10 o'clock. And now you're talking about the precision. So I'm really interested in how do you apply the precision so that you don't kill the duende, the energy, the yes. potency of it.
The spark.
The fire.
Usually my writing is inspired by a spark or a line. Sometimes a line that I hear in a country song on the radio, but I hear it wrong because right. people don't enunciate. And then that's a prompt for me that I take off and run from that. The precision comes with editing, and I trust editing. I'm an editor by trade, and I'm always willing to revise, always looking for a better word. And in fact, the book that I sent you, The Language of Crows, after it was published in 2024, I wanted to change a line in a sonnet. And I went to my publisher and I said, next time we order a bunch of books, can I change this line? Which is insane. Most publishers would go, this is crazy. You can't do that. My publisher, because he uses print on demand, and I usually order 25 books or 50 books at a time, he said, sure, change it. And it made the sonnet better. By better, I mean more clear about my intention with the sonnet. And I felt that it was more complete.
Does your intention evolve with the process of writing? Or does it stay the fixed intention from the start? Or how does that work?
No. When I'm writing, and when I hope poets are writing, that there's a surprise in the writing. The writing has a life of its own. You may find this with prose. And I can't remember who said it. It might be William Carlos Williams or Robert Frost. No surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader.
And so I think that was Robert Frost.
Okay. You have to let the poem lead you where it wants to go. And then you find out what you were writing about. I do. By the time I get to what I think is the end of the poem, then I have been somewhere I didn't know I was going. I am changed by the poem, and hopefully the reader is changed by the end of the poem. The reader's given me their time, or the listener. I owe them something for that.
So would it be fair to say that your pursuit of the end result, wherever that is over the horizon, would have its own intention that would be not necessarily exclusive of you, but perhaps slightly not of you? It has its own, the pursuit has its own intention, rather than like an actor would have the intention of, I'm going to liberate the village. So that's my intention. So off I go, and then either I succeed or I fail. This is slightly different. There's some sort of juju going on between what the poem has to say or what you think you might want to discover, and this intention that seems to be more fluid, perhaps.
The intention may be invisible at first to the poet, but as the poem evolves, then it becomes more clear. And I think part of the job of the poet for themselves and for the community is to clarify the feeling or the thought or the emotion. We use poetry as a community to commemorate all sorts of occasions, weddings, funerals, major events in the world. And I think the job of the poet, and perhaps the joy of the poet, is in clarifying the world or the feeling that goes with that occasion. It's like distilling. We concentrate that feeling into something sweeter, more powerful, more memorable. Anybody can do a rant. The poet can bring something more to the rant. The frustration, their anger, the difficulty of the world. But then the poet brings their idea for a solution, if they're lucky, or they bring themselves as a human being, or they bring a metaphor that allows us to rethink what's happening around us, an image that is distilled into something that is memorable. And lets us have feelings, but then know what to do with them.
What would be, for you, an image that has been distilled to the point where it's round enough, smooth enough, understandable enough to live in the world as a finished product? Do you have some images that you are particularly intrigued by poetically that have stuck with you?
Yes, I'd like to give you a quote and then read one of my poems, if I may.
Yeah, I'll do that.
I wrote this one down. Let me think of it. It's a line from Stanley Kunitz's poem called The Layers. And the line that struck me in that poem was, "How shall the heart be reconciled to its feast of losses?" This is a poem written by an older man. He has had a life. He talks about his tribe that he has accumulated, created for himself. And he says, "My tribe is scattered." Well, my friends are gone as I'm getting older. So many of my friends have passed. So my tribe is scattered. And I do have a feast of losses because in addition to the sorrow, I've had the joy of having special people in my life. And I've had joy of having had love in my life. And so those images stay with me. And I've got a poem that I read. Can I indulge myself?
Well, indulge us, yeah. And then by extension, yourself.
Okay. This is in my book, The Language of Crows. And I don't know if you read this one, but it's called How Many Birds Are Enough? And I'll tell you the impetus up front, and you may hear the poem differently because of that. This was written during COVID.
Okay.
And in a response to COVID. How many birds are enough? How many birds are too many to lose? This is not a poem about birds. Even when the world turns upside down and we are alone, nesting in our houses for too long, turtle doves and partridges in pear trees, where have they gone? Can we coax them back? I cannot speak in their tongues. Let the birds pause in their songs to hear my urgent silence. In 50 years, we have lost 3 billion birds. Too many to count on a Christmas morning. I cannot imagine even 1 billion no longer winging. Is our human loss less imaginable? My life list will be forever incomplete. How many ways have I been party to this disruption? it seems impossible to atone for the passing of even one robin or for the forgotten thrum of hummingbirds in Pas de Deux dancing before the red feeder. While God's eye is on the sparrow, who looks after the passenger pigeon? Who sees the tiny screech owl's flight, so fleeting in its eastern woods? There is a sanctity between plant, bird, and human, a communion with leaves and feathers lifted aloft. But how to hold the hollow bone, the fluttering heart, the onyx eye and downy wing? Are they keening their terror that spring won't come for companions gone, but not forgotten? It is not enough. I must remember, I must speak their names.
His eye is on the sparrow, but who's watching the others?
Mm-hmm.
A nice crisis of faith in the middle of that poem. Where is God? If God's so busy with the sparrow, because I think the line in the religious song is, his eyes on the sparrow, I know he watches me, is,
yes,
where is that line. And you're saying, his eye is on the sparrow, who's watching the turtle dove?
Who looks after the passenger pigeon, which is just about extinct? And so in writing about COVID, I was thinking about how many humans can we watch over? How difficult is it is for our first responders and us as a community to care about each one? That's where that line came from.
So what was your final intention after you finished with that poem? And do you remember what your original intention was?
Good question. Well, I love poems with birds in them. I'm not a birder. I don't know anything about birds, but I seem to put a lot of birds in my poems, and they are mysterious to me. And so I think I entered into mystery by saying, how many birds are too many to lose? And that was the opening line of the poem, but it may not have been the opening when I started the poem. Often the first verse or two is just warming up the poetry muscle, and you have to kiss it goodbye. But the ending, I must remember, I must speak their names, was where I ended up. And that's what I say is the takeaway from the poem. We must speak about what's happening without trying to be preachy, because I don't think that's useful. I think a lot of times people can't hear you if you're ranting and preaching, but just saying simply, we must speak their names. Don't forget these people, our ancestors, our beloveds, our friends. This is part of the loss. And yet, to quote Stanley Kunitz again, we have to reconcile the feast of losses. We can't just live with the loss. So if we speak their names, we're bringing them back into life.
Would it be fair to say that the loss becomes gain at some point, does it not?
Yes, absolutely. Because we had them. We had love. We had companionship. And remembering that helps us cope with grief.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of other poems about birds. Robert Frost, The Way a Crow Shook Down on Me, The Dust of Snow from a Hemlock Tree. Has given, yes, my heart a change of mood and saved some part of the day I rued.
Oh, good. You've memorized something.
And
have something to offer. When somebody sees a crow or when you see a crow, you are changed.
Yeah. Or Wallace Stevens' 13 Ways of Looking at a Black. I was of three minds, like a tree in which there are three blackbirds. The blackbird whirled in the autumn winds. It was a small part of the pantomime. And it just goes on and on, like 13 ways. And it's a hard one to get your head around, because the poem moves like a flock of, like a murmuration of blackbirds through the psychology, and you can't quite ever get your hand around, your head around it. And this, and I mean, I have this poem memorized, but I still stumble over the words. But the one I like the most is number six. Icicles fill the long window with barbaric glass. The shadow of the blackbird crossed it to and fro. The mood traced in the shadow, an indecipherable cause. The shadow crossed the shadow crossed the ice, not the blackbird. Blackbird's busy being a blackbird. It's the shadow. And the shadow is me watching from the inside, seeing my own shadow because of the dim sun in New England.
Imagery is so powerful, and you don't think you're a poet, but yet poetry has moved you and it's in you. And I'm so excited about that for you, because you contain that now. Your world is changed because of a poem. That's wonderful. That's our superpower as poets.
Well, it truly, truly is. And the reason I'm interested in it is because when I work with poetry, and when I say I'm a lowercase poet. I don't say I'm a poet. I say I write poetry. How many poems you want today? I'll give you 100 if you want them. I'm not a poet. I'm a driver to the airport right now. So, but you know, there's imagery, you know, in the poetry, like a poem that I it's just a little jazzy piece, but it goes, "Oh, jazz band, play that hurricane blues. Rising through the marsh grass, warmer than a coastal moon. Magic June loves steel rhythm blues and robs melancholy to make me happy. Oh, jazz band, when the air is thin, fill my mouth with night." And you know, that's just loaded with imagery. I don't know if it has much meaning, but it has a lot of imagery.
Has imagery and musicality and respect for what jazz offers, as well as respect for its own language. Mm-hmm. That's a marvelous poem. Who wrote that?
I did.
You wrote that?
Well, wonderful. Yes, I did.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I've had that. I use that a bit on stage when I'm performing with musicians. Mm-hmm. So I you know, it's sort of an opening to whatever else comes after that.
Good for you. That's great. And you've got it memorized, and you're able to pull it out into the world whenever you need it.
Let's go back to structure and word choice. And I don't know how you feel about T.S. Eliot's love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, but I love the idea of Prufrock being the spare man trying to fit in. And at the end of the poem, after he's gone through all of his Prufrocky things, meandering through society, you know, and he says, I've known the eyes already, known them all, the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase. And when I am formulated and sprawling on a pen, when I'm pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways? How should I presume? And he's always asking, how do I presume? And when you get to the end of it, he goes to the shore, and he decides he's going to roll up his pants legs. And he's, you know, do I eat a peach? Do I part my hair behind? But he says, I've heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think they'll sing to me. I do not think they'll sing to me. And what I like about form and poetry and what you're talking about is that when you pay attention to it, you give the mermaids a place to sing. And the mermaids will sing to all of us. And of course, the mermaids are the mystical creatures that wail above the sea that we don't ever see, but you always hope are out there. That's why I'm really curious about form and how you go about making those word choices, because T.S. Eliot certainly made a lot of word choices.
Yes. Well, I really see form as a container.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I write, the first draft is usually all over the place. It's rambling, or before I start the poem, my prose is rambling and diffused, and I don't know what I'm going for. And that's why I edit and edit and edit. And when I find the right word, I can hear it and know it. And with many forms, there are rhyming forms. And so you also have to think about meter and rhyme and, you know, spend time with a dictionary or a thesaurus sometimes. I enjoy putting one word into a poem that somebody has to look up if I know that it's precisely the right word. And I appreciate that when somebody else does it. And I go, what does this mean? What do I think it means? And I look it up and it doesn't mean what I thought it was. But I appreciate that it's exactly the right word.
What would be an example of a word that you would put in that would be the right word, but someone would have to look up?
I have kind of a long poem about a word that a friend of mine made up.
Why don't you read that?
That was exactly the right word at that moment.
Yeah. Somebody made up a word. Yeah. She called it, she was trying to describe how does a cashmere sweater feel? And she said, oh, I use the word mucky. My cashmere sweater is mucky.
Okay. This poem gets at that very thing, but it gets at something more. And I didn't know where I was going with it when I started. This is an elegy from my friend David Gibbish, who died in 1973. He was an instructor and a pilot for hang gliding when the sport was brand new. Mm. And he was also a nature filmmaker. He had a camera mounted on his helmet when he was flying. Here's the poem. And the epigraph, which is the introductory line, is from Elizabeth Bishop. At the end of her poem, The Fish, she said, everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. And sometimes I discover an epigraph after I read the poem, and sometimes it's the inspiration for the poem. This is called Why I Go Fishing. Not because I want to trouble the trout, but because I love the shy susurrations of a lake lapping at its shoreline. There you go. There's a word, susurrations.
And that's a good one. Yeah, I don't know what susuration means.
It's the whisper of water as it laps against something hard, like a pier or a shore. Okay. So it's the perfect word because it sounds like that, but it's also meaning goes with what I'm intending.
You answered my question, Lori. That's good. Start over.
Yeah, I've forgotten that word.
Go back to the top.
Why I go fishing. Not because I want to trouble the trout, but because I love the shy susurrations of a lake lapping at its shoreline, because the water's song unravels the day, because I relish unwinding time, thinking of words I love to roll out of my mouth, over tongue, teeth, lips, because Mycidian, your own word, Davy, created for the sinuous wonder of running your hands over velvet and silk. No one can look it up because it's not in the dictionary. It lives in memory between magic and massage. Unlike you, Davy, whose words ended too soon. Because you were rainbow, hummingbird, kestrel, a sky pilot, buffeted by gusts, that afternoon you chose to fly to be a bird. Because you, that damned rotor wind roiling off the mountain, caught your sail, brought you in too low, leaving the mangled ruin of your body entangled on the rocks 1,000 feet below. Because the chill of the moment calls me back, I slip out of timelessness and you become spectral. Earthbound anew, I concentrate on the pole's tip. Because Mycidian, because above the whisper of water, Your word floats like a blessing. And yet, when a fish finds the fly and bites, I reel it in, like catching the perfect word. Because I land the fish. I stroke its tender belly, touch the prism splash on its speckled sides. Because I'm thinking Mycenaean and mastery, which would come so near to matter in the dictionary. Because it matters, the choices we make. Because I unwind the hook, step to the edge, thinking Davy, and release the fish back to the lake.
That's absolutely top shelf.
Thank you.
It was really
heartfelt. But you're talking about making words behave the way you want them to and have meaning that is unique.
And you succeeded at that beautifully. I think you kind of knocked Elizabeth Bishop's fish off the perch.
Well, Rainbow, 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 if you've read her Villanelle, it's pretty amazing as she catches this huge fish with all these tackle and tangles hanging out of his mouth, and she releases the fish.
Yeah,
because she can't bear to stop that incredible life.
Yeah, I believe it opens. I caught a tremendous fish and held him beside the boat, half out of the water with my hook fast in the corner of his mouth. He didn't fight.
Yeah.
He hadn't fought at all. He hung, a grunting weight, battered and venerable and homely. And here and there, his brown skin hung in strips like ancient wallpaper. And its patterns of darker brown was like wallpaper. Shapes like full-blown roses, stained and lost with age. He was speckled with barnacles, fine rosettes of lime, and covered with tiny white somethings. And then I forget the rest of it. I performed that poem hundreds of times.
Wow.
It's a classic. It's a true classic. And that whole thing of where she compares it at the end, she's standing there in the boat and, you know, the boat's rusty and you've got a little oil coming out of the engine. And then I held him up. His eyes were speckled and like old isinglass, cracked a little. And, you know, and she looks at him and she says, rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. Like she's preaching, mm-hmm. Rainbow, rainbow. And then you see rainbow. And then it's sort of an afterthought. Oh. And then I let the fish go. Just like, yeah. I just tossed him back in. It's really a cool poem. But
Will you ever see a fish the same way?
Oh, no, that, you know, five old pieces of fish line, you know, four in a wire leader with a swivel still attached,
hung from
his mouth, you know, the coarse white flesh packed in like feathers, the big bones, the little bones, the shiny blacks and whites of his entrails, you know, just on and she goes, she tears the whole thing apart. Then she throws him back in. But your piece, compared to the fish, you succeeded. Hers is a little, well, maybe on purpose, the scales of her poem are very rough, like the fish.
Mm-hmm.
The scales but your poem didn't have scales. Your poem had soft fur.
It was something that felt Mycenaean.
Yeah, your poem had a different feel, but it was the same idea. And there was a much bigger, she controlled the loss in her poem. In other words, I don't have to take the fish, I'll throw him back in. You didn't control the loss. You couldn't control the fates. The fates control the moment. All you could do was control the verse.
Yes, and it's an elegy. It's praising the passing. And that was what I wanted to do, was honor this friend.
Yeah, you did.
Who had given so much to his sport, to us with his nature films, and to remember, you know, like I said in the bird poem, we must speak their names because I think it brings them back to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love the way you approach this. The pieces I read had you know, just they're just tight. They're just there. You know, it's very they're very, very clear. And I'm a bit lazy when it comes to what I do poetically, because I just generate a piece and then move on to the next piece and then move on to the next piece. And I don't spend too much time choosing those words. And I think, well, you know, I might want to rethink that.
Well, it sounds like you're writing a lot of narrative, which gives you room to describe things, show more, maybe a little telling. Poetry, you have to be more limited and precise, my opinion, be limited in the amount of time you spend with it. Precision is important. And it's framed up, particularly in form poems, but in free verse as well. As a picture or an image or a position that you take that is limited. As I say, write smaller. Don't try to write about the great big picture. If you can distill it down and concentrate it, hopefully people are changed. I read poetry out loud a lot, my own as well as when I'm judging contests or trying to understand someone else's poem, because I want to hear whether it's rhythmic and musical. And that also helps me understand if it's the right word or if it's something jarring and is that intentional or not. Sometimes right. Poets want to jar you out of your reverie.
Right. And I came out of my interest in language started in the storytelling realms, National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee in 1981, 82.
And how old were you?
How old was I? 31.
Okay.
And I saw all of these great performers on stage, Barbara Freeman, Connie Reagan Blake, J. O'Callaghan, Ed Stuyvesant, Laura Sims, God, I don't know, Milby Birch. You know, and of course, this year they'll do it again. You know, the great Minton Sparks, the poet from Nashville, Tennessee, will be on stage at the Jonesboro Festival this year.
Okay.
And but when I was there, I heard some of the poets, the storytellers telling narrative. It's not narrative, but rhymy poems like the Cremation of Sam McGee.
Oh, yes.
Or Casey at the Bat, or The Highwayman. And I was inspired. I thought, well, you know, how do they do that? Mm-hmm. And so I started there, and then I moved into, you know, my whole thing. I was never really thinking of myself as a poet, but I went on the road as a storyteller, and I was memorizing poems from the school textbook and performing them as theater for school students. So, you know, what do you want? We could, you know, at the time I could do a show K through 12, 45 minutes. You know, I could walk in and tell you what group, what year the students were in just by the way they looked. So I could pull poems out. So I started working with that. Then I thought, well, maybe I should write some. And so then I started trying to translate it into writing. Have always leaned into that storytelling, you know, like Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales. Can the cold postman with the rose on his button nose tingle down the tea tray slithered run of the chilly glinting hill? He went in his ice-bound boots like a man on fishmonger's slabs, wagged his bag like a frozen camel's hump, dizzily turned the corner on one foot. By God, he was gone. So that kind of stuff has always pulled me in.
That's poetic, and that's lyric. If you add the dimension of line breaks to that rhythm, you've got your poem. Line breaks are not arbitrary. They're things that give us room to breathe, things that help us emphasize certain words. But it's very intentional. And I'm sure Dylan Thomas was intentional about his writing. But you said something that really makes me think. You were presenting poetry to children.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what grade, but the reason I asked you when you came to poetry is that I was at a conference a few years ago, and the keynote speaker asked the audience when they came to poetry, when they knew they were poets or believed they could become poets, and who encouraged them. And almost everyone said it was third grade, and they could name the teacher, no matter how old they were. You know, for me, it was Mrs. Glassman and Miss Swanson in third and fourth grade. And so I think we must take those children seriously, must take their writing seriously, and support them in their poetry. I was just at a conference. I think I told you this. The last 4 days, I've been on screen watching and participating in a convention of, mouthful, the National Federation of State Poetry Societies. And it's a mouthful. It's not poetic, but it is thousands of people who are poets and support poetry. And so this was a gathering of poets. And in a few years ago, they added contests for children. There are 30 contests, each sponsored by a state poetry society, or big states like Texas sponsors several. But they added 3 contests for different levels of school children. And I'll say, I'm so proud of my grandkids, because the 10-year-old won first place in her division, and the 14-year-old won first place in his division. So I'm totally bragging. But they did their poems themselves, and we've been writing poems since they were quite small. They love Shel Silverstein because it's fun and lighthearted, but very rhythmic and musical. They love being read to, and now they are reading poetry, and therefore they are inspired to write poetry. And my granddaughter, who's 10, was writing a couple weeks ago, and she said, "This is my poetry parasol. When I hold this umbrella, I want to write poetry, and I want to be a poet when I grow up." And I said, "Honey, you already are." And what they need to learn is technique and permission. And we can expose them to that. Part of the reason you memorize so many poems easily is that there's rhythm and musicality as well as meaning. And the words are the right words. And so I hope to inspire that in my grandchildren. We're all immigrants. As an adult, and especially as I'm getting older, I'm an immigrant to the generation before me and after me. And I don't know their culture, and I don't know their words. And so I'm a little bit at sea when I'm trying to communicate with them. And our job is to help the immigrants acculturate and yet bring their own culture. So the kids' job is to help grandma understand their games and their words. My job is to give them tools so they can express themselves and be participants in their world and the larger world.
My mother recited a line of verse to me when I was a boy, and that's not when I necessarily knew I was inclined in the direction of poetry, but it was from Ulysses by Tennyson. "You are a part of all that you have met, yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever as you move." Of course, Ulysses says, "I am a part of all that I have met, yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever as I move." So the first poem that I memorized as an adult was Ulysses by Tennyson. And still to this day, it's one of my anchor philosophies. "Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows." You know, back to the sea.
There and, you go.
It's a great really line. Incredible.
And with the movie coming out, The Odyssey, I'm hoping some people will be inspired to read or reread the Homer, because it's a great storytelling.
I think they will be. Yeah, I think they will be. This was, of course, Tennyson's version of poor Ulysses back at the kingdom, wondering what he was going to do next, you know, which fits well for people who are in, like, I'm in my 70s. So I'm like sitting on the rock going, okay, I've been out at sea now for all this time. You know, well, where else do I go? I don't really care about hanging around here. Let's just get back out on the ocean.
But the phrase at sea has come to mean lost and in something too big for you to manage. You know, I'm all at sea about that.
Yeah, that's worth some inquiry, because some people are at sea. I knew a woman once who rode all three oceans, the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Indian Ocean, Roz Savage. Uh-huh. And she was in a rowboat. It was a very sophisticated rowboat with communication and stuff. But she spent, you know, she rode the sea. So she was at sea, but she was with the sea.
Yes.
You know, what is
that's
it?
That's very different.
Yeah, it's very different. Yeah. I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea in the sky, and all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by. John Masefield, Sea Fever. You know, let's go. Let's go out to the sea, or the road. Come, mm-hmm. follow me. So it's
all
really,
the possibilities. Yeah.
All the possibilities are out there. So poetry is an intriguing, you know, intriguing thing. Beyond the lands of your air-sweeping dreams, the wind returns again and again from the wilds of the known through the distant trees where shiny red hair mixes with bees. The clouds above and the earth below, along the rivers that always flow beyond where you're standing, past what seems will redeem your dreams when your breath floats high in the crow-wide sky. On this good day, travel alone with little thought for what you own. Walk with yourself through the perfumed sage, or go to the shore where the curlews play. And you can, too, for a moment or so, until the wind tells you it's time to go, to who you are, to what you know, to where you soar, near or far, on the red-headed wind in your sky of bees.
Mm-hmm. The red-headed wind. Oh, my goodness.
The red-headed wind in your sky of bees.
Images are incredible. Yeah.
So that's the kind of stuff I write. I mean, once I write it, I just move on. And then I leave the red-headed wind to do whatever it wants to do. And it's almost like country songs.
Yeah, that's what I say. I'm often inspired by one line out of a country song. But, you know, country music, which I enjoy, tends to repeat an image over and over and over. There'll be a chorus, and the chorus may be repeated 3 times or 5 times. And it's tiresome to me. But boy, there's a line in there that gets me, and that's a prompt. Mm-hmm. And that might be the thing in the song that's true. It might be the inspiration. It might be the distilling, the takeaway. But there's a tendency in some songs to hammer the message in.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
One of those songs. Nor is Dolly Parton's Jolene. And then, of course, Shel Silverstein wrote the Johnny Cash's biggest hit. Johnny Cash's best-selling song ever in all of his career was A Boy Named Sue. A Boy Named Sue. Shel Silverstein wrote that.
I didn't know that. Thank you.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of crossover with country music.
Yes.
And even though it's some, you know, it's repetitive, Get Me Drunk and Call Me Darling, If You Ain't Been Lied To, You Ain't Been Loved, you know, there's a lot of poetry. And, you know, Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash were best friends.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Bob Dylan changed a generation.
Yeah, but he and Johnny Cash. Yeah, Johnny Cash wrote with Bob Dylan.
Yes.
And then the Beatles, all before they hit the Beatledom, when they were kids, they were playing country music from Nashville. That would
in there. Rock and roll, Chuck Berry, and you know all the old 50s and early 60s rock and rollers and blues, and you know we can find our truth in any place if we're receptive.
Yeah. And poetry, like what you were writing with your the elegy for your friend there, that's country. And one of the things I've come to realize about country music is yes, it is confined to Nashville. You know, you've got to have a pickup truck. You got to have somebody dying, and you got to have some beer and a lost love.
Pickup truck, a dog, and your mama.
Something like that. But that's on the surface. But the country,
exactly.
The country that we come from, the place where we live, the dirt we walk on, that's what makes us. And how we express it with language, verse, songs, it all ends up belonging to the voice of who we are. And the voice is the song. So the country song is not just a Nashville thing. It is the song of country.
We have to acknowledge the size of things. Country music, I think, does that, the human experience, very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
it does.
It's accessible, if I use that word again. A lot of people can understand it and relate to it. The scope of country music is very large. Mm-hmm. Human condition.
Yeah, that's true.
Emily Dickinson says, tell the truth, but tell it slant. And that's what country music and much music does. You have to listen and get the message. They may not hit you over the head with it. I think it's the poet's responsibility to tell truth to power and to speak our truth, but tell it slant. And yet, love, 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 to quote the Beatles, all you need is love. With tenderness, if we're lucky, with respect. We don't know what burdens people are carrying. That phrase came from Rosemary Wautola Trummer, wonderful poet. She's written a poem a day for more than 20 years as a practice. It's a spiritual practice for her. But then she posts them on her website, which I think takes huge courage. Terrific human being and terrific poet. As she says, we don't know the impact that one word may have. It's the pebble in the water that poets can drop, and yet we may have a huge impact. We don't know. That's a privilege we're not privy to. And yet, when there's authoritarianism, the first thing they do is silence the poets, because we're dropping those pebbles in the water that can ripple out to revolution. That's why I say, you know, we need to bring solutions to our poems, not just preach, but give a reader a takeaway that is something useful.
Well, your poems have done that for me, just listening to you read them. And I'm looking at my clock and realizing we are now 55 minutes into our time together.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's been very easy to talk with you.
Top of the hour. How would people get in touch with you so they can track what you're up to?
LoriWolf.com. And that's spelled LoriWolfe. .com. They can order my books that way by contacting me, or they can contact me through my email. Books are available on Amazon. There are many Lori Wolfs in this country, some that spell Lori the same way I do. So you have to say writer or poet, and in order to find me, you can Google me. I'm in Colorado. This has been great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're so welcome, and I appreciate it so much. And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Lori Wolf. She inspired me with her notions of form in this conversation. So I've decided that I'm going to attempt to write a sestina. Sestina is a 39-line poem that has a repetitive, not so much rhyme scheme, but word scheme. Six words per stanza, six lines per stanza, and you've got to repeat the words in a different order each time. So I've been watching Ken Burns' country music docuseries and been inspired by all of the country musicians. And while I was never a really great country musician, I did play the guitar with my father, and I did listen to WSM
and coming out of Nashville, Tennessee, when I was a child, and watching that show, I've recognized so many of the people that influenced me, and in a way, even though I'm not able to sing, I am able to generate language from the spoken word point of view. And when I say I can't sing, what I mean is I have a very difficult time hitting the notes because I can't quite hear it. But it doesn't mean that I don't enjoy the way my voice plays out over the air. So thanks to Lori, I'm now attempting kind of a country music sestina that probably won't make a lot of sense, but it will be a rather imaginative proposition. So on that note, who knows where it'll go? I'll get back to you when it's finished. And that's about it for now. So thank you ever so much for tuning in to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Thank you, Walter Parks, for the theme song, walterparks.com, for more on Walter's music. Devine Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Robin Collier and Mike Tilley, thank you for doing the same. KCEIFM, Cultural Energy Radio in Taos, New Mexico, broadcasting up into Alamosa, Colorado. So how about that? If you'd like to write, you can always join me on Saturday. I have a little writing community. It's on Zoom. We gather, have great fun, and the door's always open. You can go to imaginativestorm.com for more on that if you like to write. And if you are anywhere in the world, you can be there because we have people coming in from all over the place. And if you'd like to reach me, nave@jamesnave.com. Nave spelled N-A-V-E. Would love to hear from you. So there you go. That's it. I do hope you come back sometime soon. Till then, maybe I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
And I hope it's similar to the joy you have on listening to it. Is I get to go through 500, 600, maybe 1,000 songs, just listen for a few seconds, just flip through them real quick. But what a privilege. What a joy. It's like something that royalty would get. You get to listen to 500 new songs a week. And the fact is, anybody can do that. But I never thought it was possible. I just never thought of it. But really, anybody can do that at any time. Most music these days, you can hear it on the internet. And just take a little bit of time and flip through a bunch of songs. You don't have to listen to the whole thing, just listen a little bit. And the best part about it is a lot of commercial entities channel you into a certain kind of music. They have what they call predictive algorithms. It's just top 40 radio all over again. Here, this is the kind of stuff you like. We'll give you a whole bunch of it. And we'll keep repeating it over and over again because, well, that's where all the money is. But this station says, let's do different things. Let's listen to music you've never heard before. And let's not repeat it. It's a joy, isn't it? Thank you for joining. Thank you for being part of this.
Well, you're a sunny boy. You take a head first dive into anything. You do the mood swing. You call it rock and roll. And when you rock on the pole, you don't shake it all. You're steady as the stream. Oh, you're a working man. You say it's cold outside, can you let me in? I need some dough. But the banker says, say I got 13 dogs that'll kill you, son. No, you don't break my bread. Don't break my bread. I am so scared. Don't break my bread. In all the prisons cried, we didn't do anything, he didn't prove none. No, you kidnap off the street. They get a government laugh. And a little cage with all the other ones. The panic attack. All under the businessman. eagle flying, yeah, killing everyone. Picking up time, got a smoking one. And in the other hand, gunny got an